G'day. Indy Wood is my name. Welcome to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues and events from around the Bega Valley. This week, we catch up with local resident Jan Harris. Jan and her family own a property on Vimy Ridge Road outside Tarthra, and Jan's looking at the continued impact that fires like the Reedy Swamp Road fire that did major damage to Tarthra and surrounds in 2018, and the Yankees Gap fire that took a number of houses on Yankees Gap Road outside Bemboka in that same year, 2018. And of course, as we do each week here on The Local Update, we'll catch up with local resident Graham Farram. This week, Graham continues his exploration of the early days of the Bega Valley through the eyes of former owners and editors of Bega newspapers from times gone by.
With the help of W.A. Bill Bailey's History of Bega, I've been tracing the early history of newspapers in and around Bega. In the early 1940s, reporting on an early entry, the 10th of the 11th, 1865, to the diary of the newly arrived teacher, W.H. Brain, Bailey can say, even as late as 1865, Brain caught a koala or native bear in the street. Some 20 years later, Brain, as editor of the Bega Gazette, reports on an interview with an early resident of Bega, Joshua Higgs, who would have been in his 70s at the time. This is from the Bega Gazette, the 7th of the 7th, 1883. Joshua Higgs, circa 1810 to 1891. The emus were thick in those days and ran about in mobs. In the early 1980s, I had the pleasure of seeing a mob of emus south of Toowoomba in the early morning one day. That memory brought to mind a poem by Mary Fullerton. She was 1868 to 1946, published in Classic Australian Verse and Short Stories. This is the chapter People and Places. It's a summit book. First edition, 2002. It's in our local library, pages 392 and 393. It's simply emus. My annals have it so. A thing my mother saw nigh 80 years ago with happiness and awe. Along a level hill, a clearing in wild space, and night's last tardy chill yet damp on morning's face. Sight never to forget, solemn against the sky, in stately silhouette, 10 emus walking by. One after one they went, in line and without haste, on their unknown intent, 10 emus grandly paced. She, used to hedged-in fields, watched them go filing past into the great bush wild, silent and dark. Sudden that hour she knew this far place was good, this mighty land, and new for soul's hardihood, for hearts that love the strange, that carry wonder, the bush, the hills, the range, and the dark flats under. She's also done some other work, which I might get around to too. She did Games of the Bush Children, and spoke about the bush school that she went to. She grew up in a bark hut at Glen Maggie in Victoria, so just the other side of our range, coastal range down there in Victoria. I really like that poem, and it always brings back that early morning in Toowoomba for me. T.J. Monahan, in his 30th of August 1987 edition, gives in his intro an observation. Here's Bailey's passion for local history and his habit of spending long hours with dusty newspapers and old identities was considered by locals to be somewhat eccentric, to say the least. Well, he certainly made good use of his researches. I've counted over 50 entries quoting newspaper reports. This one would have been relatively easy for Beeger Gazette editor Brain, given he was honorary secretary of the first Beeger Show Committee. More animals. Here we go. Bailey records. On February the 15th, 1872, the first Beeger Show was held. The entries comprised 37 of horses and 24 of cattle, 8 of pigs and 70 of sundry articles. The Beeger Gazette of 23rd of the 2nd, 1872 reported, Mr. Jaunting very kindly placed his paddock at the back of the School of Arts and one on the other side of Gift Street at the disposal of the society, and in these the stock was shown. A number of pens were constructed on the School of Arts grounds for the reception of pigs. Some of the cattle found accommodation in the courtyard paddock, and one entry, a fine, fat, unruly bullock, had to be yarded in Mr. Burns' stockyard. We might speak of Mr. Burns later. I'm really sorry that the show society couldn't arrange something for us. They thought that the show might go ahead after the fires. They thought that they might be able to just put on a free event for the people. They haven't been able to do any of that, and I believe that the Sydney Royal Easter Show has actually had to go online. So we've had travel restrictions, and we've had some lifting of that recently. I thought it might be interesting to look at conditions on the roads, as reported in the Beeger Gazette. This is as close as I've got to travelling the roads around here at the moment. I've been in isolation. But between 1877 and 1881, Oswald Welby, who, like Brain, had been a schoolteacher in Beeger, was editor. On the 27th of the 12th, 1877, in the Beeger Gazette, he reports, the Tarpa Road. Many portions of this highway, one of the most important and frequented in the district, are in a dangerous condition. It is at considerable risk that a drive to the port can be undertaken. Ruts, holes, and blind stumps abound. In some parts, where the foundation of the road consists of logs, these logs have caught fire, and as they burn, the superincumbent earth cracks and falls, destroying the roadway. Well, the Tarpa Road, and Gillery's talking about there with that corded road. That's what they used to do in wet places, lay down logs one after the other and then fill over the top of that. But of course, when the flood's on, well, there's no going that way at all. And before we really had bridges and the punt, any flood of the Beeger River would really slow things down for people to get their produce, to go anywhere, to get to the coast, get on a steamer. All of that was rather difficult. Here's the 3rd of the 1st, 1878. So we're still with Oswald Welby at the time. The road to Gabago is well and unfavourably known. An effort should be made to get a bridge over the Brogo. That tenter trier, Brogo Pinch, has to be ascended and descended. There is a level track that many horsemen follow and which clearly indicates where the road ought to go. Well, it took a few years before a new road was put in there, and the bridge has had various manifestations. Here we are going a bit north again. It was not until 1880 that a mail coach was supplied between Beeger and Maruya on the 1st of the 1st, 1880. If the infamous condition of the road does not interfere with his, the owner's intention, that mail coach was going to run. By June 9, 1883, Brain was back in the editorial chair and gave room in the Gazette of that day to D. Sheehan, Tarraganda Crossing. On my way home from Bega, it was nearly dark when I reached Tarraganda and, to my surprise, found a team of powerful horses fast in the treacherous riverbed. Another strong team was hitched on, but all was no use. There were men and horses perishing in the cold water at a time when the hour was late and the teamsters ought to have been at home. Presently a bullock team came along, and by its aid the triply banked dray was hauled ashore, but with difficulty. Such events happened daily in the Tarraganda River for days after heavy showers. Now, my last offering today is from the pen of Henry Lawson. This was written in 1897 as a favourite of the Bega Valley Historical Society President Peter Rogers. This is a bit of a belated birthday present for Peter. The Lights of Cobb and Co. From Poetical Works of Henry Lawson. It was first published in 1918 by Angus and Robinson. There is a shortened version of it in the Songs of Henry Lawson, which music compiled by Chris Kempster. It's an introduction by Manny Clark, who was here for many years. It's the Viking O'Neill Penguin from 1989. He says, Mr. De Kempster, I assume, in its heyday, Cobb & Co. had 20,000 horses spread throughout the stopping stations along the coach route. A fresh team of horses would be ready when the coach pulled in, giving a team that might have worked right through the night a much-needed spell. Well, that happens. I'm reading the full version from the Poetical Work. The Lights of Cobb and Co. Fire lighted. On the table, a meal for sleepy men. A lantern in the stable. A jingle now and then. The mail coach looming darkly by light of moon and star. The growl of sleepy voices. A candle in the bar. A stumble in the passage of folk with wits abroad. A swear word from the bedroom. The shout of all aboard. Chuck, chuck, get up, hold fast there. And down the range we go. 500 miles of scattered camps will watch for Cobb and Co. Old coaching days already decaying for their sins. Uncounted halfway houses and scores of 10-mile inns. Riders from the stations by lonely granite peaks. The black boys for the shepherds on sheep and cattle creeks. The roaring camps of Googong and many a digger's rest. The diggers on the Lachlan. The huts of further west. Some 20,000 exiles who sailed for weal or woe. The bravest hearts of 20 lands will wait for Cobb and Co. The morning star has vanished. The fog, frost and fog are gone. If one of those grand mornings which but on mountains dawn, a flask of friendly whiskey, each other's hopes we share, and throw our topcoats open to drink the mountain air. The roads are rare to travel, and life seems all complete. The grind of wheels on gravel, the trot of horses' feet, the trot, trot, trot and canter as down the spur we go. The green sweeps to horizon's blue, the call for Cobb and Co. We take a bright girl actress through western dust and dams, to bear the home world message and sing the sinful cant, to stir our hearts and break them, wild hearts that hope and ache. Ah, when she thinks again of these, her own must nearly break. 5 miles beside the goldfield, a loud and triumphant shout, 500 cheering diggers have snatched the horses out, with Auld Lang Syne in chorus. Through roaring camps they go. They cheer for her and cheer for home and cheer for Cobb and Co. three lamps above the ridges, and gorges dark and deep, a flash on sandstone cuttings where sheer the sidlings sweep, a flash on shrouded wagons, on water ghastly white, weird bush and scattered remnants of rushes in the night. Across the swollen river, a flash beyond the ford, ride hard to warn the driver, he's drunk or mad, good Lord. But on the bank to westward, a broad and cheerful glow, new camps extend across the plains, new routes for Cobb & Co. Swish scramble up the sidling, where teams climb inch by inch, pause bird-like on the summit, then breakneck down the pinch. By clear, ridge country rivers and gaps where tracks run high, where waits the lonely horseman, cut clear against the sky. Past haunted halfway houses, where convicts made the bricks, scrub yards and new bark shanties, we dash with five and six. Through stringy bark and blue gum and box and pine we go. 100 miles shall see tonight the lights of Cobb & Co. Well, 100 miles, that's quite an effort. I don't know if you remember Indigo. Some years ago now, I'm back in my memory, there was a sort of reenactment of Cobb & Co. And it came through Bega. It came up through Victoria, the back country down there, through Bonang, all dirt roads still then, over Dr. George and further north, all reported in the newspaper, but I'll have to look it up. I do remember photographs. Standing in the main street of Bega and then off over Dr. George Mountain and the way, 100 miles overnight. Quite remarkable, to do that even today on some of our roads would be considered an achievement.
You talked about travel a little bit in last week's episode as well. You talked about the journey from Marimbula to Tathra.
Across Bornda.
In parts up the beach, which took 7.5 hours to do 27 kilometres or something stupid.
25, yeah. Yeah, no, that was brain coming to be a teacher at the National School here in Bega.
Yeah.
He did that for 3 years. But when he had the editorial chair for the Bega Gazette, after that journey, his first arrival... Well, yes, I guess he was rather keen on talking about improving travelling conditions down here. And, of course, that agitation in its way, they didn't have the radio then. People were spread out. The newspaper was very, very important. And, of course, the Gazette eventually became our Bega District News. And I don't know if they published on Friday, but they did do a rather good, although small, edition for Anzac Day, which I did manage to pick up on the rare occasion when it was my turn to go and do the shopping.
Graham Farram is a long-term resident of the Bega Valley. He's also had a career as a bookseller, is an artist, and for a long time now has been affiliated with the Bega Pioneers Museum. We catch up with him each week to find out what he's found in the collections of the Bega Library, his own personal collection, or, of course, the Bega Pioneers Museum. On the afternoon of March 18, 2018, strong winds caused power lines on Reedy Swamp Road to blow together, causing a spark. That spark caused a grass fire, which took off along the Bega River. Within half an hour, had engulfed Tathra and the communities surrounding it. In that fire, some 70 houses were lost, including mine. Also in that collection was Jan Harris, who lives with her family on Vimy Ridge Road, outside Tathra. I caught up with Jan recently, and she told me that it's hard sometimes to not feel like you've been forgotten after the recent summer that we've had with what they're now calling the Black Summer fires and then the COVID-19 event. And one of the biggest battles that Jan has is that with the speed of redevelopment after the fires, there doesn't seem to be enough time to stop and check and make sure people are feeling okay, or to acknowledge the fact that maybe people aren't feeling all right and need to just talk about the way things are feeling and the way things are going.
One of the things is how our responses are different to each event, and they should be the same. The if one house is lost, that the grief and loss and sorrow is no less than if 100 houses are lost, but our response is different.
Mm.
And so in that different response, we are sort of collectively saying your loss isn't as serious or as profound or, you know, as worthy of our consideration. So I think as a community, and hopefully in New South Wales, having specifically appointed somebody to look at disaster management in the Shane Fitzgibbon, that ad hoc response to disasters might change, and that we have a, you know, standard procedure where we react in the same way with, you know, generosity and thoughtfulness and, you know, ensuring that people all get the same deal.
Are the events around that fire being considered, included in this Royal Commission?
No.
They're not. Wow.
No, the Royal Commission is specifically about the Black Summer fires, I think they're called.
Right, the recent fire.
That's right. So the fires from Yankees Gap aren't being considered as either.
That must really say something to survivors of that event, because it was a big event.
It was a big event, and it certainly does, and it certainly does also to the people from the Yankee Gap fire. And, you know, I have spoken privately to people involved in both fires, and it does say something. It's also interesting that there's a coronial inquest into the March 18th fire, but have you heard anything about that in the media? So there was a question asked earlier in the year by the Jodie McKay in the New South Wales Parliament, asking when that coronial inquest was going to be held, and the response from the Liberal Party was that it already had been held, which is actually obviously incorrect. And and that coronial inquest is due to occur in August in Bega, at the Bega Courthouse. So it's interesting that there's nothing about that happening.
Do you see us having... Do we take something away? Do we learn something from that March 18 fire?
I'm not sure.
In response to the recent fire?
I'm not saying that it has, but, you know, I think the communications were probably better in the recent fire. So I think people probably got a little bit obsessed by the Fires Near Me app. The language around everything is very specific, and it's very driven, and it's, you know, we're recovering, we're moving on, we're moving forward. So I don't think there's a lot of space for talking about the now and how we're feeling and, you know.
From what I've read and from talking to you now, you sound like perhaps you've learnt a lot, though, about the importance of trying to protect the environment around you and trying to change the attitudes and thoughts of governments and our community.
Oh, absolutely. The climate has always been important, but I think the people's personal experience of what can occur when we're not being mindful of the climate is a powerful story, and hopefully that's one thing that you know, one positive thing that gives much more strength to the urgency of what needs to occur to sort out the climate, and that those painful stories, as painful as they are in retelling, are powerful stories that do make people stop and listen. And if you can use that for good, well, that is one positive thing out of it all, isn't it?
You have recently become one of the founding members of the Bushfire Survivors Climate Action Group. Where did that come from and what's your hope with that?
A couple of people were talking about stuff, and Joe Dodds, who is one of our neighbours, who spoke very publicly after the March 2018 and actually checked in with people and certainly spoke to John and Evan, our son, whether we were comfortable in her speaking about the climate and its impact so soon after the fires, to which we replied we were. At the time, we didn't feel we were capable of voicing anything on our own. And so through that came the group. And so now in that group of people who've been involved in fires in the Blue Mountains, the Black Saturday fires, and it's just, it's really giving a voice to our concerns about the climate and using our survival of these crises to add weight to what we're saying.
One of the things that's come up a few times in this sort of COVID time is making us stop using things, doing things, perhaps has done some good things for the environment. Is there concern about us just going back to the way things were?
I think that's one of the myths of recovery. Having spoken to people who lost everything in the Black Saturday fires, you don't go back to the same thing. You go back to a different thing, and hopefully the different thing you've learned some things from and you improve the world around you. So I don't think we'll go back to the same thing. I'm not sure what we'll go back to, but hopefully people have reassessed some of the things that they think are important.
Is there anything else in particular that the message that you'd like to get out, anything else that we need to talk about in any way?
I think we need to definitely allow more space about talking about what's occurred to people, and that, you know, just because it's out of the media eye, it's not over. And just because somebody's, you know, I've spoken to somebody, a couple of people that have rebuilt and are in their houses after March 2018, and there's still issues for people. So, you know, I think the disaster creates ongoing stuff, some of which is good, some of which is not good. And we as communities don't seem to be very good at dealing with that. And I think that's part of that thing about having a clear, same response to whatever the size and scope of the disaster is, that our response is the same for everyone.
I guess the first question I should have really asked you here, Jan, is, are you guys okay?
Look, it would depend on any given day. Some days I would say I'm quite hopeful. Other days I'm full of despair. And, you know, yesterday when I drove home from work and when you drive across Dula Flat, you can see our hill.
Mm.
And sometimes that makes me incredibly sad. And I was thinking, because there's been a lot of stuff about in the media because of the sad resignation of Mike Kelly.
Mm.
About, you know, Eden Monaro, you know, people have been forgotten and stuff. And I'm thinking, yeah, well, you know, yes, we have. Not that I begrudge anybody anything, you know, other people being happy or looked after that's not a negative.
No.
But we need to ensure that everybody's looked after. Look, individually, the people that have done the recovery stuff are great people. In that recovery stuff, it's that momentum of moving forward, and there's no space to talk about how sad you feel or how lost you feel. So I don't think that's going to change.
Mm.
It's remarkable how easily people criticise you. What do you mean you haven't rebuilt? Why haven't you rebuilt? Mm. You know, what's wrong? Other people have rebuilt. You say it's complicated.
Yeah.
Well, you know, why is it complicated for you? And, you know, like, actually, you know what? I really don't want to talk about it. You know, whatever. But so for lots of, and it's painful. Everything's tricky. And I know people have had dreadful falling outs with neighbours.
Mm.
And because of, you know, when houses were cleared, the land is no longer at the same height. So retaining walls that's put in, and well, that's on your land, and I'm not paying for half of it. And, you know,
it all so gets difficult, doesn't it? Yeah.
There's a whole lot of other sorrows that have sort of occurred because of that. And those, and they're still part of all that, they're still part of that March 18 day. So, you know, so it's the recovery and moving on aren't the kind of simple things that sort of are easily portrayed in the media. And frankly, people want, you know, the afterwards they want, you know, happy stories. They don't want to hear that it's difficult for you.
Jan Harris is a resident of Vimy Ridge Road outside Tathra. She and her family were one of roughly 70 families that lost houses in the fires of March 2018. You're listening to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues and events from around the Bega Valley. Produced by Indie Media and available from indiemedia.com.au. My name's Indy Wood. Thank you for your company this week. We'll catch you again next week. Bye now.